Good afternoon. This is Dr. Dan Guerra, and this is Authentic Biochemistry Podcast. Today, of course, is the 19th day of March 2024. That makes it St. Joseph's Day, a very important holiday for us in Chicago. And we used to celebrate it. We didn't get to do what the St. Patrick's Day people did, which was dye the Chicago River green. We couldn't dye it some other color like red, but we still had our day. So I'm remembering that. And now we're going to enter into mosaic number 3. We finished with plasmalogens, and hopefully you enjoyed that last lecture. That was synthesis. And I did a little tongue-in-cheek there about music, but the association was when a person decides that there is a fundamental rule based on dialectical event ontological argumentation, then you proceed with that until it can be refuted by new evidence. So science works that way, and new evidence comes in all the time. Now, you notice that the music affectation I brought up about Mozart and about the Beatles, one could argue, well, that's not really a dialectical argument. That's more like an opinion. Now, I think that's a good argument against what I said about the music. But that's all the more reason why when you listen to true, authentic research scientific discussions, you should always ask whether or not what you're hearing is something to do with opinion or with a true dialectical argument, where there are premises, there are either several premises and then a discussion of those premises, the old-fashioned dialectic, the Platonic, or the more modern way you have a thesis, antithesis, and synthesis. I tend to use a fusion of both. But at any rate, the important point there was that when one examines the hypothetical deductions in scientific research, you have to keep in mind that all of those deductions that led to the configuration of that research, and by that I mean, of course, experimental design, and then the execution of the experiments, and the discussion of the results of the experiments, determining evidence and then coming up with an induction after all of that, is of course always influenced by the research scientist and the research science community, which has control over peer-reviewed research. That's a component of what it means to say peer-reviewed. So even though I was right about Mozart and the Beatles, sometimes mere opinion is spot on, is correct, particularly when one thinks about Kant's critique of judgment. Now, when we're talking about aesthetic principles, we talk about things that are beautiful, things that have an effect on our feelings rather than on our intellect, such as music, then I was perfectly within my right position. And it is, I think, an odd thing if someone listens to Mozart and says, well, I don't like that. I don't know what you're talking about. And indeed, I even say, I realize I'm a child of the 60s, but I would say the same thing about the Beatles. And not every single, almost every single Beatles song. Now, I'm not counting any of the individual performers in the Beatles and their solo careers. No. Just when the Beatles were together. Okay, so that's enough of that. Now, mosaic number 3 is going to be a lot of fun. Took some time to think about it, and I've come up with a discussion of inflammasomes. So let's get started with that. First of all, I want to remind you of what a dialectical event analogical method is, because that's how we do this discussion in authentic biochemistry. It is an adaptational, temporally processive investigation of biochemical and sometimes also physiological events, employing the dialectical method, which I just explained to you, to expose and then to interrogate oppositional empirical and rational evidence through scientific methods of hypothetical deduction and inductive synthesis toward what I call an event ontological knowledge architectonic. So we know that there is a well-established immunoepigenetic tailoring of neural, endocrine, digestive, cardiovascular, adipose, muscular, and metabolic response to the micro and macro environment. And this occurs through classical constitutive surveillance and acquired effector cellular and humoral defense mechanisms using reversible covalent modification and hydrophobic interactions, of course, involving nucleic acids, carbohydrates, proteins, and lipids. So a synthesis of these phenomena toward a central molecular theory for free will-driven, agency-based existing individual adaptation and assimilation that better explains the core event ontology of human development, decline, and death at the molecular level should obtain a sharper grasp of the physiological process that become chronically compromised during aging and onset of disease. So that's what I mean by our dialectical event ontological method in our lectures. So using a method like that centers on stark detail of heterotrophic biochemical phenomena within cellular networks controlled by individual agency within a changing environment. Now that requires the analysis of the spatiotemporal dimensions of free energy flux. And what obtains, of course, is a living event ontology. Human biology is such a unique paradigm. Okay. So there's more I can say about the diaventome, but I'm going to save that. I'm going to do a video lecture, I think, next. We're going to cover all of this in greater detail. And I want to explain that because I want you to understand how I use dialectical event ontology to prepare all these lectures and how I view the biochemical events which occur in living systems. But for that, I think I'm going to put it off and wait until we do that video lecture, which many people have been asking about, and I promise. So I've got to do it. Now, the beginning now of Mosaic 3. I know we're well into this lecture, but I just had to cover some deficits in my previous discussions and then reintroduce the way we're doing these lectures and this whole program called Authentic Biochemistry Podcast. So today we're going to start talking about a paper published. In fact, it's still in press in the Journal of Biological Chemistry, March 2024. That would be now. And this is a really interesting paper, so I think you're going to like it. So let's give an introduction to it. The human integument, also known as skin, obtains the highest surface area organ of the body. Now, the epidermis, which is the outermost layer of the skin, you know, regulates water loss via evaporative cooling associated perspiration. Skin also controls electrolyte balance and sebaceous gland surface lipid exudation. Plus, the epidermis instantiates the major immune barrier to exogenous pathogens, parasites, photooxidation, melanocyte light absorption, and the primary, of course, xenobiotic barrier. So we need to introduce, of course, the discussion of ultraviolet light here. UV radiation penetrates the epidermis. And exposure to certain wavelengths of UV radiation, especially UVB, of course, that wavelength goes from 280 to 320 nanometer, may cause thymidine dimerization and subsequently mutating DNA damage. So the pathophysiological presentation is the cutaneous inflammatory response. And what do we call that? Common language? Sunburn. So according to this JBC paper, there's 2 billion sunburn injuries during peak summertime light exposure every year. And that's linked to, of course, the potential to melanoma, most common skin cancer. Now, you know that these DNA mutations can be below the level of an oncogenic event, ontology, but will nevertheless damage the epidermis, and subsequent chronic high photon flux density of UVB on unprotected skin may actually overcome normal repair, because there is a repair for the dimerization of thymidine, and then also overcome the protection, and that will lead potentially to long-term disease manifestation. So the central feature of this pathobiochemical event we're going to be putting under the microscope is the formation of the intracellular inflammasome. Okay? Now, inflammasomes are cytosolic molecular platforms. And what they do is they sense pathogens, and they also sense, via signal transduction, cellular damage. And what occurs because of inflammasome induction is a facilitation of the secretion of interleukin 1 beta and interleukin 18. And that initiates or instigates the inflammatory response. And of course, that's going to start regulating the initial phases of the induction of the innate immune system. Now, even though inflammasomes are critical for defense, and their defense against bacteria, virus, fungi, parasites, there is a very tight, stringent regulation of their activation. Of course, that has to be absolutely necessary. And in fact, I wouldn't even call it indispensable. To prevent what? To prevent an inappropriate pro-inflammatory response. Now, that's particularly significant when we talk about this particular subcellular platform, and we're going to give it more of a title than just an inflammasome. We're going to call it the NLRP3 inflammasome, for reasons you'll see in a moment. Those are activated in response, of course, to pathogens, or pathogens, or that is microorganisms that are not pathogens, but nevertheless carry virulence factors or allergens. But also inflammasomes are triggered by self-derived metabolic disorders. Hello, immune diseases. Hello, inappropriate expression of any gene product. Also, inflammasomes are involved in neuronal diseases and, yes, because I brought it up earlier, age-related degeneration. So the NLRP3 inflammasome is activated by chemical and environmental stimuli. And one of the environmental stimuli is UVB radiation. So what is that component of the regulation of the inflammasome that is specifically associated with UV-induced NLRP3 inflammasome activation. And how does that function to either give the sunburn response, which most of us know when we're out in the sun, as soon as the weather gets warmer, and it's going to start tomorrow because tomorrow's first day of spring, how does that become repealed or blocked so that there isn't a generation of an excessive pro-inflammatory response in the skin, sensu strictu? Now, classical autophagy has to now be brought into our discussion. We've talked about autophagy many times in Authentic Biochemistry podcast. I'm going to now bring it back up under the auspices of this JBC paper. It is an intracellular degradation of macromolecules and sometimes organelles that are all then used to resynthesize macromolecules, DNA, RNA, protein, membrane lipid, via what can be called a recycling system. Now, I don't like the word recycling, because when a protein is broken down to its individual amino acids via proteolysis, those amino acids no longer have the signature of that protein, unless you're talking about the mole percent that's in that given micro environment, nano environment, let's say, but just one class of proteins being degraded in, let's say, in the ER. So it's not really recycling. It's essentially the generation of the building blocks of all those macromolecular and organellar structures, right? Yes. It's making them available now for nascent macromolecular and organellar resynthesis, or just simple synthesis, depending on how you want to look at it. Now, in mammalian autophagy, and autophagy occurs in all living systems at some level, the cytoplasmic constituents we just talked about, polypeptides, complex carbohydrates, complex nucleic acids, complex lipids, as well as organelles, they'll all become enveloped by another structure called an autophagosome. And what the autophagosome does is fuse, so it's a membrane-membrane contact organized event with the lysosome. So you have an autophagosome fusing with the lysosome. So you have a phagolysosomal structure generated. And that will go on to finally carry out the degradation of the sequestered cargo. So the lysosomal pathway of autophagy has been discussed. We know a lot about it. In fact, the lysosomal pathway can also remove pathogens, and even, for example, viruses, virus particles. So it's playing a significant role in any kind of potential, even non-virulent, non-pathogenic, but nevertheless, introduction of microorganism into a cell. But also, of course, any errant diapedesis of macromolecular structures, or even such things as just, you know, organic acids. If they're entering the cell inappropriately, then the autophagolysosome will function to remove that particular xenobiotic in that organized event example I just gave you. Okay, and so the issue of autophagy is to maintain cellular homeostasis so that the cell does not go through any form of programmed cell death, such as apoptosis, ferroptosis. Okay, you understand? So a cell fate, it's a cell fate that doesn't cause the cell to be completely removed from the tissue, right? Nevertheless, the cell can still function, although there's going to be a temporal signature of when that cell is up and running again. And during that time, that cell can be challenged by many biochemical events, such as the appropriate amount of ATP-generating systems, the amount of glucose, the amount of amino acids, the amount of lipid that can be used for bioenergetics, right? So that's where autophagy can sometimes fail. And what happens then, in association with mitochondrial phagy and peroxisomal phagy is a complete removal of that potential bioenergetic organeller offering. When that occurs, the cell will probably go through programmed cell death. Now, there's another thing that can happen with cell fate, of course, just with that program. The cell can just necrose, right? And also the cell can prematurely age, which is senesce, right? So you understand autophagy is going to be associated with a sunburn event here, is typically considered involved in controlling the potentiation of disease-causing microorganism invasion. But any kind of disease, even to some extent, diseases that start off as an oncogenic event, can be controlled by the initial phases of autophagy, such as starving the cell from ATP by going through mitophagy, right? Therefore, limiting electron transport chain, oxidative phosphorylation, and the only amount of ATP available would be glycolysis. But we know the tumor is able to evade all of that, right? We know that we have glycolysis in tumors that is supporting the entire tumor growth, expansion, and division, right? That's the Warburg effect, right? Remember the Warburg effect. So autophagy is essentially always occurring at some level. That's the other thing I want to bring up. Most biochemists won't tell you that, but basically all cells are partially going through an autophagic response unless they are robustly active and dividing. And that's because the cell has to recover damaged protein, damaged nucleic acid, both DNA and RNA, as well as damaged lipid. And that's all essentially an autophagous phenomenon. Autophagous just means eating itself, right? Yeah, it's a phagos, right? Latin word. All right. Now, inflammatory diseases, many of them, not all, but pro-inflammatory diseases sometimes present with autophagic dysfunction. And of course, what would be the molecular players? Well, we have talked about these in the past many times, authentic biochemistry, but you know, again, I don't expect you to be thinking about it now. But there are two really important autophagy-related genes, ATG5 and 7. And when they are inappropriately expressed or active, they can cause aberrant inflammasome superactivation. That can lead to certain very high morbidity metabolic disorders, including neuronal diseases, which are indeed metabolic disorders, but also standard diseases we talk about, such as cardiovascular disease and atherosclerosis, which are, of course, one of the largest killers in humans, right? All right. Now, let me check my time here. I do want to make sure I don't go over. Okay. Yeah, we're doing fine. We're doing fine. All right. So, let's pick up this discussion and continue on. Let's talk more about inflammasomes, okay? Paper published back in 2022 will give us more information just about inflammasomes in general. So we're leaving the 2024 paper in press right now, and we're going to go in to discuss inflammasomes from just Dr. Guerra's archives, right? Of course. So mitochondrial DNA leaking from stressed mitochondria, which can include such things as increases in reactive oxygen levels, will provoke inflammation via the Cgas-Sting pathway. The Cgas-Sting pathway is activated, indeed, when oxidized mitochondrial DNA, effectively binds to the cytosolic NLRP3, thereby triggering inflammasome activation. The NLRP3 inflammasome activators will rapidly stimulate uniporter-mediated calcium uptake. And what does that do to the mitochondria? It opens up mitochondrial permeability transition pores. Those have an acronym, of course. You might as well learn it. Small m, PTPs. Those pores, when they're open, will trigger a major gateway in and out of the mitochondria. And what will happen because of that is a certain protein within the membrane called the voltage-dependent anion channel, VDAC, will dimerize. And that will mediate a dialectic between metabolism and cell death. So within mitochondria, excuse me, hold on a second here. I just lost my place. Oxidized, excuse me, mitochondrial DNA will either be repaired by DNA glycosylase, that's the OGG1 enzyme, or it will be cleaved by the endonuclease known as FEN1. So oxidized mitochondrial DNA, which can be generated because of this cGAS-STING pathway, generating this whole process that went downstream. Remember how you get oxidized? Mitochondrial DNA is from too high of a level of reactive oxygen because of some kind of corruption electron transport chain, typically. Remember, electron transport chains taking molecular oxygen and reducing it one electron at a time to H2O. So if that gets corrupted, you build up ROS, or reactive oxygen species. Of course, superoxide, hydrogen peroxide, even the hydroxyl anion, right? All right. Now, especially associated with iron. So this oxidized mitochondrial DNA will be repaired either by the DNA glycosylase, the OGG1, or it can be cleaved by an endonuclease, FEN1. When it's cleaved by the endonuclease, you end up with 500 to 650 base pair fragments. Those base pair fragments exit the mitochondria via the MPTP and VDAC dependent channel just generated. And what will that do? That will initiate cytosolic NLRP3 inflammasome activation. So oxidized mitochondrial DNA fragments also activate the cGAS-STING signaling, and that gives rise to an entire cascade of pro-inflammatory extracellular DNA release. Okay. Now, there are some treatments for chronic inflammatory diseases that have already been looked at by the pharmaceutical companies. Those include FEN1 inhibition. And when FEN1 is inhibited with some of these organic compounds, these inhibitors, you can actually see downstream a suppressed IL-1 beta production and a decrease in mitochondrial DNA release. Now, most of that work, up to including about 2022, was done, of course, in mice. Okay. All right. So let's see here. I think I want to check my time one more time here. Hold on. Sorry about that. I'm doing a different way. Yeah, I got to end here, I think. Okay. Yeah, I only have a minute left. So the very next thing I'm going to talk about is how NLRP3 inflammasome got its name. And then we're going to further detail how that inflammasome functions in normal physiology, in pathophysiology, amongst a couple of different potentiating diseases, which are pro-inflammatory in presentation. And then we'll get back to that paper in press in JBC March, which is going to be talking about sunburn and the inflammasome. So hopefully that was a fun lecture. It's going to be the third mosaic. That was lecture one. Dr. Dan Guerra wishing you a pleasant Tuesday afternoon. One of my favorite songs by the Moody Blues, of course. Saying bye for now.